Wednesday, March 26, 1997. Trauma shadowed all four sessions in the spring. I found President Clinton laid out on a special cot installed in his formal dining room next to the tiny kitchen. He said there had been one more big step than he thought from Greg Norman's patio, so his toes went down and backward to wedge his heel at an angle against the riser. He heard a loud pop and screamed, knowing instantly that it was bad, and it would have been worse if Norman had not caught him on the way down. He was just learning how to put on his pants over a stiff knee with its thick brace, but he could not yet reach his socks. On tape, he described the March summit in Helsinki between two pathetic creatures, himself, the week after his popped knee, and a gaunt, pasty Boris Yeltsin, 50 pounds lighter after his own heart surgery. The president said they had snarled at each other more than once, saying, "That's bullshit, and you know it," but kept coming back against lowball expectations on both sides until they reached four major agreements whose significance had not yet registered. They found a winning strategy at last for ratification of the START II treaty by the Russian Duma. To do so, they outlined a surprise START III treaty, which was intended to achieve an 80% reduction in combined nuclear warheads. Finally, they negotiated U.S. stabilization assistance for Russia's new market structures, along with sweeteners for Russia to acquiesce in NATO expansion near her borders. We discussed few topics before Bruce Lindsay came primed for a ritual of convalescence. He had rounded up only one staff lawyer working this late, and the medical aides pronounced themselves forbidden to play cards on duty. Therefore, I was drafted for one game of four-handed hearts that extended into second chances and playoffs for 3 hours until nearly 1 o'clock. Conversation tended toward swagger and gossip beneath a tissue of presidential etiquette. Respectfully, no one spoke Clinton's first name in the presence of others, but it was acceptable to growl, "Mr. President, don't you fuck me with this pass." Thursday, April 3, 1997. 8 nights later, hoping to make up for the truncated session, I found him still headquartered on the dining room cot in slippers. He hobbled on crutches to work on the breakfast table of the little kitchen next door, eating a bowl of chicken and bean soup. There, much of our taped conversation explored the tightening gloom in the Middle East since March 13th. When a berserk Jordanian soldier had murdered 7 Israeli schoolgirls hiking on a field trip near the border. Since then, Prime Minister Netanyahu sent bulldozers to begin the construction of Israeli settlements between the Palestinian town of Bethlehem and Arab settlements in East Jerusalem. 3 days later, a Palestinian suicide bomber killed 3 Israeli women in Tel Aviv. The president analyzed a tight vise of reprisal. 90% of Israelis believed that Arafat ordered the bombing, but 78% continued to support the peace process anyway. Yet the celebrated Oslo Accords of 1993, which prescribed a step-by-step climb from logistical relief to peace, was no longer a functional model. Just the day before yesterday, at the White House, Clinton had heard firsthand of King Hussein's surprise journey to knock at the homes of all 7 murdered schoolgirls in Israel, kneeling to beg each bereaved, astonished family to forgive not him or his deranged soldier, but the wound to abiding peace. Hussein thought a complex dual sovereignty could apportion fair boundaries and secure access to all sacred sites. Even this wisp of hope disappeared on the Syrian front, where Clinton's review was more military and technical. Without the Golan Heights, what guarantees prevented a perfect storm blitz to cut Israel in half from the north? Chelsea came in to discuss college choices. She had not yet heard from Princeton or Brown. As our diary subjects succumbed to fatigue, Hillary stopped by wishing she could go to bed, but she had to get her hair done first because her roots were showing. "I love your roots," the president told her with a weary smile. He said his knee was improving with 2 hours of therapy today, but he took several painkillers while we talked. I asked for 2 aspirin myself. Wednesday, April 23rd, 1997. He had a bowl of fruit at the same kitchen spot when we resumed toward the end of April, with his bum leg propped up on a chair and a kind of body stocking. Exhausted, he started brusquely on tape. The Peruvians finally had stormed the Tupac Amaru 2 days ago, rescuing most of the hostages, killing terrorists who tried to surrender. End of story, he said. He preempted one question by reading from my notepad about a court decision overturning the line item veto. We're going to appeal, he said, waving me on. We switched to military appointments for the new term. Over a few insinuations of cronyism, President Clinton had just elevated General Wesley Clark to head the NATO command. He said the prosaic truth was that he and Clark had grown up 50 miles apart, paired as freakishly rare Rhodes Scholars in that area, yet never met in Arkansas. They hardly knew each other. And Clark got the NATO post for an exemplary record capped by success in Bosnia. A deeper cause for backbiting was that some peers considered Clark too much an intellectual. Hillary joined us for a while, curious to observe the diary process. She also wanted to look in on the president because he had suffered a devastating allergy attack this morning after the helicopter ride. He needed more rest. We touched briefly on a book they were reading about how parents could survive a child's first year in college. I asked on tape about delayed Senate ratification of the International Treaty on Chemical Warfare, and President Clinton reviewed his protracted negotiations in the treaty room with Foreign Relations Chair Jesse Helms. He had satisfied Helms on 27 of 30 objections, plus half of the 28th. Helms would vote against ratification no matter what, but Clinton predicted, accurately, an overwhelming win with every Democrat and more than half the Republicans. What was remarkable to the president was the very existence of an opposition bloc. He said some churlish senators spurned any cooperation with the larger world. Hillary left before the president's mordant press review. He said Maureen Dowd was so jaundiced that she dumped on Tiger Woods after he won the Masters by 12 strokes. Clinton digressed into reasons why the 21-year-old kid would change golf, with fitness and athleticism beyond Greg Norman's exercises, plus mental focus to elevate a gentleman's game. Remembering also a phone call to tell Woods that his best shot was the hug afterward for his father. In the New York Times, Dowd had seized on Woods's regretful decline of a White House invitation to excoriate him for impertinently dissing the President of the United States, and she managed to double back against Clinton in the next sentence for craving the aura of celebrity athletes. She must live in mortal fear, he guessed, that there's somebody in the world living a healthy and productive life.